Hosted
I think
by
we're
Bitcoin.
On, right?
We are.
We
Welcome
are.
To another episode of Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
We have the best intro of
we do.
All podcasts.
We just say it. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Say it.
Just say it.
Like be an autist.
We don't.
Yeah.
People have floated the idea of intro music, but maybe we'll just have DK sing or Max rap.
Would you like to, you know, Jake, give us a little song?
Maybe not we can compose maybe, something. Maybe, I don't
not
know.
Not on demand.
Improv.
I'm down to freestyle. You just give me.
Well, we don't want to have as me singing because then.
I am bringing it back though. I'm in a cover band, or I was in a cover band.
Yeah, a little while ago.
And
yeah.
I kind of quit because I was traveling and stuff. And then they're like, oh, we got a gig. It's going to be a great one. Can you do it? So I'm actually going to do a gig in Menlo Park.
I want to come. Where?
In October.
All right.
The Guild Theater.
I've been before.
The Guild Theater.
The Guild Theater. Yeah. That's big time.
They said it's like nice. They just remodeled it or something.
Super nice. I went there for Thievery Corporation in December.
Yeah.
It's especially if you get there's like some seated area over the stage. It's super, super
nice. Oh, but
I'm
going to be rapping. It's covered.
Seriously?
I'm going to be rapping too, yeah.
Oh, I haven't.
Oh, okay.
In that case, October,
I think there's a lightning conference or something.
Jay-Z.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. Wow, okay. I got to hear that. I can vouch for DK singing classic covers.
Yeah.
But I don't know about rapping.
On the subject of music, I wasn't going to talk about this now, but a couple things. This morning, yesterday, I don't know what it was. If you guys check out my Noster account, I shared an excellent set of remixes from some old Mad Lib, Quasimodo, Jay Dilla tapes. Phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. I was like researching, like, who the hell is this guy? Pseudonymous French dude. You know, French always had the best taste, even in hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me fired up again. I'm like, you know what? I need to play with these new models. I've got actually some beats I've been sitting on, but I need to play with these new models. It's time this year, I need to drop a new track, at least generated the beat by AI and make it as good as that.
Have you played with, what was he doing? Logic Pro?
No.
So, you know Logic Pro, right?
It's like GarageBand, but
it's like the pro version of GarageBand.
Yeah.
So we were doing a little bit of music prep, rehearsal, kind of analysis prep for the gig this past week.
Okay.
And one of the guys on there had Logic Pro, and they just have like AI features built into Logic Pro where you can drop like a wave file of a proper recording.
Yeah.
And it will separate it into stems.
Oh, shit.
And they see, I was like, this is
just
crazy.
Automatically.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it was blowing my 8-year-old mind. I was like, I was trying to do this stuff.
You're 8 or 80 year old?
My 8-year-old
depends
mind.
On the day.
We were just talking about I forget the context, but I was I was trying to share that Matt and DK and I have a lot of experience. So then I'm like, I added it up, like, oh my God. Like when it comes to computer programming and stuff, we have over a collective hundred, like a century.
Wow.
And I think it's like 130 years.
Got more experience than me.
Oh, wow. Wow. That's a very polite way of saying.
But it really made us feel old. Oh, wow. Like century.
To my dear geriatric friends, I'm so glad y'all are here.
Fortunately, it's as easy as just speaking English now. So.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, no, but and this is a reminder. We should still try and get a track together.
Yeah.
Now as the AI features get better, you could do a really good beat. Something else on the music front. I don't know why I'm feeling inspired on this, but I just want to mention it. You know, I haven't played around with the sort of Noster music clients for a while. But, Wavelake obviously has their hosting and Fountain. And I just got on Wavelake to see their featured stuff. Because, back in the old days, and shout out to these companies. I love Sam. I love Oscar. Invested in their companies. Friends with these guys. But man, when I first started listening to Wavelake, I was so excited. I was like, this is fucking awesome. You can send Bitcoin. People are going to love this. And I remember pulling up to Anjali and I was like, let's see the first trending track. And it was like a sea shanty praising Michael Saylor. And I was just like, man, this is like,
oh no,
done. Like, this is so bad. So bad. But I just went and discovered Sam, who has great editorial taste and has been sort of in the indie music game doing merchant fulfillment services, like to the tune of like a major, like shockingly big business for like 15 years. Anyways, he has these like editorial picks and I like listened to a couple of them. They were good. I listened to one track and I was like, oh my God, this is like a 10 out of 10 that I would have like loved to have found on a music blog or on Spotify rec. It's the first time on a Noster client I found music that I would have listened to off of a Noster client. That to me is like a big sign. So they're starting to be like actual good bands on there, which is dope.
Love it. Love to see it.
Yeah.
All right. Are we ready for the topics of the day?
Yeah.
Shall we get into it?
Well, you want to start with your story?
I want to start with the story. Okay. Yeah. So on the subject of consumer apps, block, which has Tidal, also has a little app, which maybe some of you guys have heard of, Cash App. So yesterday I had lunch with a mutual friend and we were talking more about energy stuff for the majority of the lunch. And then at some point I was like, oh, what do you think about BTC? Like, is it dead? You know? And
did he say that?
No, he didn't say that exactly. I'm being somewhat facetious.
He sometimes kind of asked me that.
Yeah.
To be like provocative, I think.
I think like directionally. Yeah, I mean, yeah. you know, my answer is like, you know, BTC is fine. Like AI is the like, you know, the sexy wave to ride, and but like BTC is great. But the powerful moment came when we were eating at our favorite mutual restaurant. And the woman was so excited. I was like, all right, you know, we're ready to pay in Bitcoin. She's like, yeah. Like now she loves it. Like at first, uh-huh. like, and oh, shout.
Caviar X?
Yeah.
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 She,
thanks for doctoring, Steve.
Sorry. Well, sorry. No, but they, I totally agree. Yeah. She her attitude has been a complete 180.
180.
She wants to put put table tents on every table promoting Bitcoin.
And she like smiled so big. She's like, yeah. Like she's like, remember, you gotta click Bitcoin on there. And I was like, okay. Anyway, so she was so excited. And for months when we tried to convert, she was like, nah, I'm busy, like talk to my manager. What is this weird thing? No. Now, you know, shout out to I know some of the PB members did that. But now she's like the biggest fan of
and I think it's important what that transition was because she was just like, I don't know. I can talk to the manager, the boss, whatever. And then it became kind of like a default. And she's like, oh, okay. Yeah. Let's figure out how to use it because that's part of how the thing just works. I don't have to convince anybody. So she didn't have to do any work. And then we started coming in using it. And then that's what kind of drove the excitement. So I think there's like a bit of a lesson in there. Like you're
100%.
You know, getting it set up is kind of hard, making it default. Lets people like us come in there, and then us coming in there drives excitement from her.
Totally, and the fact, I mean, we do some volume there, like you know, as a group, so that helps too. But now she's just like, I don't know, like I imagine if your day is like constantly the same thing to have like a new technology to play with, it's just fun.
Yeah.
And so everyone tips her well too. And I think there's something very important in that, which we should discuss an idea. But anyway, so I was like, all right, I got to show you this. Lunch is on me, but I got to show you. And he's like, okay. So I did the payment, and he was like, wow, like so you paid with that with Bitcoin? I was like, well, actually, I paid with dollars. Over the Lightning Network. And he was like, okay. So you bought dollars, sold it for Bitcoin, sent it, she sold it for dollars. I'm like, yeah. He's like, that's amazing. And I was like, guess how much fees were? He's like, what? Zero. And I was like, guess who just died? Visa. Well, we're not supposed to say that part out loud. But anyways, he was just like mind blown when he realized it. I was like, oh shit. Then when I showed him the screenshot later, and I was like, this is the first time this has happened for me. So full disclosure, the first time I tried buying with Bitcoin, there was like, actually like, there were some issues, some errors, but it's come a long way. I just got 5% back in Bitcoin. So, you know, whatever, I got almost $2 back. Lunch was $35
What was that? I don't know about that. Is that like a rewards thing?
Yeah.
We talked about it
on the show. Where were you?
maybe I just didn't connect it to that.
He's too busy preparing for his music.
It was part of the Vegas update. One of the announcements from Block was 5% back in Bitcoin. If you use Cash App to pay at a Square terminal.
Okay.
Yeah.
But crypto, I think Bitcoin it's or like dollars.
Through
Bitcoin or dollars.
Through the end
you
of the
year. You can pay either way.
That nuance is really interesting, right? Because it's funny.
Huge.
What's funny is you can have a person, like a Cash App customer, can never have owned Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And then they, if they discover this feature, which again, we talked about before, and that's still a challenge, but if they do pay dollars over Lightning, then they get 5% back in Bitcoin and converts them to, or at least, is an introduction to Bitcoin.
They start stacking. And like to me, there's so much that can be done and I'm sure will be done to surface that feature because all of a sudden now, like even I, like obviously I'm like as big of a fan as you're going to find. I love Cash App. I love Bitcoin. Like, of course I want to do all these things. But now I'm starting to think about this. I'm like, well, shit. Like one of the reasons I would never use this before is like, well, at least with your credit card, you get some points, maybe eventually get a flight or something out of it. Like, might as well just use the credit card. But now it's like 5% cash back on Bitcoin. That's like the best offer out there. For the asset that I most want, like that's much like psychologically in my own psychology, I was just like, fuck, I want to pay everything with Cash App now. Like, why would I ever use a credit card again, ever? If they'll accept it, of course.
Yeah. So I think the word needs to be spread.
Yeah.
People got to listen to PBJ.
So if our mutual friend is listening,
people, we not only have to say it, we have to bang it over.
Because I think I have to like imagine the experience and really feel
now,
it.
Now we have your friend experience.
Yeah, exactly. He can take you next time. But like critically, like, you know, and I think this is important to acknowledge as well is like, you know, in San Francisco, you know, Cash App has some people, but it's, you know, Venmo was winning here. Cash App is like the South. And so he was like, yeah, you know, why would I use Cash App? And then I showed him that. He's like, all right, refer me now. And then the referral bonus on top of that, which we both get. So that just
refer
like,
me like he didn't even have,
he didn't
cash
have Cash App. But now I'm going to get an extra $10 from the referral.
Nice.
In hopefully Bitcoin? Paid in Bitcoin. I don't know. I would love that. That would be cool if they did. Every referral bonus from now on should be paid in Bitcoin too.
Bitcoin referrals.
That would be dope.
Oh, there you go.
But the point is now, you know, he's going to start using this. And mm-hmm. then he's going to tell, like, this yep. could go viral. Mm-hmm. Like, this could be the best thing that ever happened to Cash App. And what would make
it could be kind of, I mean, that's going to be any other rewards program where they kind of chase you around a hamster wheel to like redeem your points and stuff. Right?
Well, even like, I think he was using, I don't know if it was Fold or Coinbase. They both have Bitcoin back rewards, but that's 4%. I think, or I think Coinbase is 4. So 5% now he's like, shit, like this should be the default.
So if this doesn't get people using it, what in the world is required?
Well, but it needs to be surfaced because even I was just kind of like, oh, like I have to figure, and then I was shocked. And I was like, oh, this actually worked? What? The other idea though, that I think would be amazing, and I know obviously Cash App can't subsidize this forever, but at least for some period of time, imagine you were able to, as a merchant, not even the merchant itself, but the person at the cash register, you also have your cash tag or Lightning address. And imagine whatever I get, 5% back to me, 5% back to her. I mean,
to the business.
To the business or even to the person working the register.
Oh, so is that the tip idea you're talking about?
Yeah. So it's like your tip gets doubled or like there's some like mm-hmm. multiplier paid critically in Bitcoin. Like
from who? The customer or Block?
A Block is what I was thinking. As like, start, yeah, just but free money. Have you considered issuing digital credit to
people? But what's the incentive here? Because you want the worker to
have a great become experience. To become a Bitcoiner.
A bigger advocate, I guess.
Yeah.
Imagine every time I go.
The reason is so that they explain to their customers to use
pay Bitcoin.
Right. They're kind of the one who's the final.
Okay, I agree with that.
You know, the last.
And another thing I would even consider, I mean, it would be great if Block just gave me 5% and her 5% subsidize it for a while. I would also be okay even sharing my 5% with her because I'm like, I want this to work, right? But my point is like, she's already super enthusiastic. Imagine how enthusiastic she's going to be if she starts getting a stack. It starts growing. She sees the value go up. She's going to become in the cult.
Yeah.
I almost feel like if you're the one paying the in the Bitcoin ecosystem and you're getting the 5% and you're tipping her anyway, just tip with like, take that 5% and split it.
I'm cool with that too. And what I would also love.
It's like neutral cost-wise. Right?
Well, I mean, another idea that would be cheaper for Block is let me tip her in Bitcoin. Like yesterday I gave, obviously, I mean, I really like the lady, so I always give her a nice tip regardless. And like, you know, she's helping us out. But imagine if I could just be like, tip, and it gets paid to her in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I would pay. I mean, I am paying the tip.
Steve, did we ever discuss your startup idea?
MoTips?
Yeah.
Yeah.
MoTips.
Uh-oh. We have not discussed it on the show.
This is basically...
MoTips.
Yeah, this is like circa 2010 or something
this was,
like that.
Yeah. Just pre-Lightning.
No, I just, I had a frustration. By the way, we're getting some great comments here, including people from Cash App who are visiting PB today.
Oh,
and they're listening to our show, which is great.
Let's go.
But no, MoTips, it was just my frustration of, you know, historically, you would pay various service workers in cash as a tip. Like if you went to a hotel and you wanted to like tip someone, you'd give them cash. Well, then most people moved to a digital money world and then that broke. So then I always felt, and I don't carry cash.
Yeah.
So then I feel guilty. It's like, I don't have any money to tip the person. I want to tip the person. How do I do it? And then you get into this, it's socially awkward. And oh, do you have this app or that app or whatever? Yeah. Like it would be,
what's your social
skill? It would be nice if you just had a very simple way to bump or tap or whatever phones. Proximity and give them a tip.
Smash phone.
Anyways, and there's a bunch of details there, but that was the idea.
Smash a server over here.
But I don't think it really. I mean, I never really pursued it because I don't think people. It's not really a like doesn't pass the toothbrush test.
The what?
The toothbrush test.
The hell is the toothbrush test?
Wow. How does he not know what the
Do you know what this is?
Yeah.
I thought we're all from Silicon Valley.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't realize this was the PB PBJ retirement. So y'all tell me what this is.
No, like a product, a habit or a product that you do daily.
Oh.
Well, like, at least some people max brush their teeth every day.
I'm a twice a day. That's good.
That's good. So like MoTips didn't seem like something that you would like use every day. Yeah. So you know, that hurts adoption. But obviously, and then like Bitcoin's clearly the way to get this done.
I like the idea. Sounds like you have a new vibe coded out.
Well, but basically I'm saying the experience that you're describing is
motives.
A lot of what, it's like the substrate or the foundation on which you could, yeah, have this thing end to end really work well these days.
To be clear, I thought the toothbrush test was if you're getting in close enough to give a tip or something. And I was like, I mean,
if they have a good,
you want to make sure they have good breath.
Good breath. Yeah. Okay. All right.
It's a good toothbrush.
I like that. I like that. Anyway, yeah. So it's great that that your friend had this positive experience.
Yeah. So now, I mean, so everyone we bring over,
that Bitcoin is still a thing.
I don't know if he's convinced or not, but he wants that free 5% cash back. So.
How does cost basis tracking work when that happens? Or do you just sort of assume that won't be a problem and de minimis stuff will get passed? And
well, if you're paying in dollars, what's your cost basis for those dollars?
No, if you get a 5% reward,
you're getting dripped
all this Bitcoin every once in a while.
They track that.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
I mean, disclaimer, I'm not a CPA or a lawyer. If you acquire Bitcoin, you don't pay taxes until you sell, right?
Right, but there's a cost basis.
Oh, well, I mean, a Cash App, you get like a report from Cash App.
Okay, so that's already part of how Cash App works.
Yes, it is.
They provide you a tax form which shows all your transactions, and I haven't verified it for this particular feature, but in general, provide like a CSV with all that data.
DK, what is this this word you've used? Selling, I think? Have you been listening to a lot of MicroStrategy and Michael Saylor lately? I've never heard you use that word before.
I thought
you
always sell your Bitcoin, isn't it? Always sell your Bitcoin.
Always.
As long as you buy more than you can sell. That's what the word in the street is.
Yeah, I like it. Steve's up to date.
Net buyer.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Is that the intro? Was that a gentle introduction to topic number one?
Yeah.
Well, so topic number one is Saylor to sell Bitcoin.
Yeah, I was trying to thread the needle for you. Just like, let me just...
Thank you. Yeah, little...
That's a basketball reference. Yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Use the layup metaphor. Yeah. We might struggle with that.
Exactly. Smash away, Duke.
Okay. Well, do you know what that is? That's the intro to the Saylor part.
Oh,
he's trying to do. He's no Max.
I can't do
when
the,
it comes to Saylor.
Just tell
the
us
Saylor
about
impression.
Your capital.
So MicroStrategy had their earnings announcement this past week, right? And I feel like both our real PB chat, which welcome back, is Max is now part of again, and then also some other people. It feels like this has been just a hot topic that. I feel like as much as we've talked about it for years now and kind of studied it and tried to get our heads around it, I feel like we still don't really have the kind of clarity that I would expect we would end up with after spending a bunch of years on it. And maybe that's because it's evolving quickly and changing, or maybe there's enough other perspectives that we're missing that maybe aren't included in that. But I felt like it kind of all hung together and made sense. But even smart people that we know are kind of taking a very opposite view, which is fine. I want to hear where we understand or where we're getting it wrong. But
another recent thing is just with the news we talked about last week with 21 merging with Strike and the mining arm of Tether.
Is that official yet, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that last week.
Well, I'm curious
as to whether it is.
If anything has changed since last week. Okay, no.
I don't know.
I haven't received it.
I think it's... I don't know. I didn't verify it.
Cool.
But that's another. That's why we were talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, what is 21 strategy? Like last year, there's this flurry of Bitcoin treasury companies, with 21 being like the most formidable competitor, perhaps to strategy. Yeah. And so, what does that merger mean? And what's 21's? Are they a Bitcoin treasury company?
I felt like
or do they actually want to make money like the old fashioned way?
Right. And it felt like everybody was coming out. When we say a Bitcoin treasury company, I'll just say like Steve was the one pushing, I think even from the first episode, like is it
literally the first episode?
The first episode.
November 2020?
Right? Out in the bullpen out there. But is it a company that's designed to issue you know, issue shares to sell to buy Bitcoin, and that's like the whole purpose of the business? Or is it a business that has some other revenue generating business and they sort of keep a portion of their treasury in Bitcoin? Those are like actually very different structures, very different operationally what you do to be successful at those.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like, you know, 21 and I guess Strive, is that the other one that's kind of big? And Metaplan, and they kind of, the CEO always gets up and says, hey, we're going to try to increase Bitcoin per share. That's like they heard it from Saylor, and so they repeat that, and that becomes like the talking point. But I don't feel like anybody else is really getting there with that the way he is. And so I hear 21, and they're doing like the mining thing, and they're doing the, I think they've got like a loans business, or maybe the Strike business has got a big loans component because they've got the big couple of $1 billion on the balance sheet, as a debt facility. But all of that to me makes sense. It almost to me feels more like, you know, like Berkshire Hathaway for Bitcoin. Like own a conglomerate, own a bunch of operating companies, and generate a bunch of revenue, and don't, yeah, hold treasury if you want, but you're not selling securities to try to buy Bitcoin, and that is not increased Bitcoin per share. So my understanding as of yesterday, now 21 is not doing the increased Bitcoin per share thing. They're doing more like what I was calling Berkshire Hathaway for Bitcoin.
My understanding, but I haven't like done anything, and I haven't investigated anything more than what you've seen. So
okay.
And we just but it also does, it makes sense to me. I mean, this the whole time we've been discussing this, it makes no sense to me that every this character
it's
somehow
like Facebook,
Facebook should be a Bitcoin treasury company. Never
Forget
made sense to
AI.
Me. Usually we come to resolutions and get on the same page. This topic we haven't.
Yeah.
I don't know if it matters, but in any case, it always
can you imagine Zach up there.
To be fair, I'm not saying every company
is to increase Bitcoin per share.
Well, eventually they will. But I'm not saying everyone should be playing the Saylor strategy. I think when I said that, I was still lumping in the Block and Saylor strategies on one continuum. I think every company should be stacking their profits in Bitcoin, I believe, unless they have a more profitable use of that. And so, to be fair, I would revise my statement to say, if I'm, you know, Meta, Google, Anthropic, OpenAI, or XAI, or Tesla, I probably have a more highly creative, profitable way to reinvest my earnings, which is to buy more compute, build more AI. Okay. Yeah. Everyone else, though?
And that's why it's sensible for many companies to keep a lot of their treasury in dollars.
Yeah.
If they believe they'll deploy those on a short time frame, even medium term, like clearly within 1 year, and even up to 4 years, it makes sense to keep that in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And then anything beyond that, there's a good argument to be made for Bitcoin. But that's a very different structure than going levered and literally selling your shares to funds just to buy Bitcoin.
Yeah.
That's like an entirely different business that most companies are not cut out to do. And there's just not market room to do that. Even Strategy themselves are struggling, or my understanding is that they're not doing as well selling to bondholders and or like bond funds and equity funds.
So far. I mean, I think it'll come.
Is that because of the ratings agencies and stuff?
That's part of it.
I don't even know if it's true.
Yeah.
It's my impression or what I've heard.
I mean, I think that's relative.
But clearly the other Bitcoin treasury companies are not doing well and they're all pivoting or dying or whatever. Yeah. And it always made sense to me that you only get so many sales pitches to bond funds and equity funds. And so there can't be thousands of companies doing this. At most, it would be like one or two companies per jurisdiction.
Per region,
even that, I didn't really believe, but I could imagine that.
Yeah,
to me, the outcome is more like it's like
one
strategy and that's it.
So I want to be clear on this. Like that has also been my position for a long time, is that like, you know, personally, I'm extremely long strategy and extremely like neutral to short everything else in the Bitcoin treasury market, with the exception of like if you have some jurisdictional arbitrage, like Metaplanet probably is going to do fine because MicroStrategy can't play in Japan yet. But they'll get there, right? So I actually generally agree with you on all that. And I want to be clear, when I was saying all the companies should become Bitcoin companies or at least stack their profits if they have profits in Bitcoin, I think what I was implicitly saying there was at that time, which was, you know, very long in AI terms, like a year and a half ago, implicitly that's saying I think most public companies are out of good ideas. Implicitly, I'm saying I just don't, like I am short basically every company in the United States, except now I've revised that for the companies, the five companies I mentioned, and perhaps a new company on the block that may have some
so anti-American
team, not VOO.
I don't even know what that is. What is VOO?
That's the
S&P 500.
Yeah.
It's an S&P 500. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. It's not controversial. Believing in America, believing in economic growth.
Bro, I believe
that
in
has been working for many, 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 many decades.
Bitcoin is the most American thing I know of.
Yeah. Is Coca-Cola going to surprise you with their next move?
Anyways, my point is I have adjusted that. And I think if you're in the AI race, you should be reinvesting your profits in AI.
But in any case, circling back to strategy and like, yeah, one of our other good friends was, I guess, well, I think, because I think the three of us have kind of converged. Mm-hmm. So it's not super interesting for us to just talk about all of our agreement. Yeah. So one of our friends had a little different take and was a little more skeptical on Stretch. Like, I think the three of us are pretty bullish on Stretch. Yeah. I think it's, and just in general, strategies, financial engineering. But our friend, he kind of thinks that Stretch is tapped out right now. That they're not going to that issuing more Stretch is going to slow down and demand will wither. And the argument is that because of risk of repaying or paying the dividends, and you know, without appreciation of Bitcoin price, there's less collateral to protect that. So I think his argument is that an investor accepting, or you know, deciding to buy Stretch, get 11.5%, and accepting the risks of that is going to be more hesitant going forward because of the ratios of, like, you know, the collateral to being able to pay those dividends. I haven't done the math, so I simply can't. I don't have a sense for how much additional risk there is per marginal dollar. I mean, one thing we talked about is like where the dollars can come from to pay the dividends. There's a lot of sources. At a really high level, I think at least the three of us believe that as long as Bitcoin appreciates more than 11.5% annually over a long period of time, zoom out. And I think we all believe that. Strategy believes that. I think our friend believes that too. Mm-hmm. But that the structure and model that Strategy's chosen is protected. They don't need like Bitcoin to moon in the next month or in 2026. Mm-hmm. It just needs to appreciate more than 11.5% CAGR over a long period of time.
I think it's better news than that. I think it's 2.27%.
Oh, for Stretch Holder, because they are at the near the top of the funnel to get paid off in a bankruptcy. Yeah, so it's even better than that. But I think
I don't even think it requires getting into like a liquidation scenario. I think it's just the way the balance sheet works. I think you need Bitcoin to grow 2.27%.
Okay, so for context, DK was listening to our friend Captain Sailor Moon and
at
3 a.m. or something. So we know he was extremely interested. I was listening to that on the way over to get as much as I could. I didn't fully understand this point. And there's a lot of things in there. So I would say my understanding coming into this was generally what Steve described. However, having listened to Sailor, he was claiming, no, it's not 11.5% CAGR we need, but like whatever, 3% or 2.something%. Explain that. Or your understanding. Ooh. Let me put you on the spot.
Yeah. You know what? I think to do a proper explanation, I think you need to map out a lot, and I don't feel like super equipped to do that right here. I would guess that I would think about like Strategy as a tool. You know, there's a bunch of tools in this toolkit, right? And one thing that I don't hear people like our other friend who is got a lot more questions, I think, than we do, is if you break it down to like a single share of STRC, think about that. They sell a share of Stretch to the market and they will never buy that share of Stretch back. That's definitely came from the moon.
Yeah.
That's out in the market and they're never going to buy it back. And so they then have taken the $100. They have that as collateral. That's new collateral that didn't exist before they issued and sold that thing. So now that's new collateral. They can allocate that 100% to Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. You can allocate that 100% to USD if they have previous STRC or other USD obligations coming up. So they can allocate it 100% to USD, 100% to BTC, 80-20, 20-80, 50-50. You can do whatever you want, right? So you have a lot of flexibility when that $100 comes in. So I don't see the problem. And then the 11.5% is not like due the next day. Mm-hmm. The 11.5% is due over the course of the next year, right?
Well, so, but you have monthly obligations on that, right? Although technically
over the course, yeah. But meaning like, I don't know, what if you're going to pay 11.5% per year?
That's 8 years or something. Yeah. So I think that I'm just trying to channel the energy from our friend.
Yeah.
which I don't fully understand, but I'll do my best. But I think
I would like to be able to represent it better.
So in that scenario, $100 comes in, and let's say it's parked in, it's kept in dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, and then you have to pay the dividends, and you get 8 years or so with that. Maybe it's a little more because you earn interest. I don't know. I mean, let's just call it 8 years. Our friend doesn't think that's there's going to be buyers of Stretch with that bargain.
Yeah, so I totally disagree on that point. I think there are real risks. So I'll try to represent what I understood from the conversation yesterday. And I think there's a point that we were kind of debating on that I want to stretch because I think stress. Because I think it's very important. So
that'd be a good ticker, huh? Stress.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, stress is like the super levered one. Like the start MSTR our 80% yield. 10. Yeah, exactly.
101 levered.
Exactly. Levered. The Dogecoin product.
101 levered Dogecoin fund.
Dude,
stress.
And the crazy thing is, I could see that just like killing the market. People love stress. So my understanding of it is at a very sort of like my explain it like I'm five understanding is he's got a giant stack of Bitcoin. He's trying to over collateralize at least 5-to-1, I don't know, 6-to-1, whatever it is for any Stretch he offers. So I think the really, really, really important point for me is there is some collateralization, over collateralization ratio that he views as, you know, sufficiently conservative. I think he has the ability to shift that, and it's something worth watching. This is a risk over time, is that maybe someone starts off like super conservative and then they just kind of start loosening it up. And like one day, maybe, you know, 20 years down the future, you know, we're back to, you know, traditional banking or something. So I do think that's worth watching. But as of right now, my understanding is he's like 5-6x over collateralized. Okay. So he pays out this monthly dividend, which is about to go bi-monthly if they get the shareholder vote. And, you know, the biggest risk that I see. So if we take sort of three classes of questions that came out, one class of questions was, you know, from our friend, is there going to be demand for Stretch beyond another $20 billion? To me, that is like obvious. Yes.
It seems obvious.
Like,
yes.
Like without a doubt.
But the demand side could fail there.
But let me just test that.
Sure.
Again, I don't know the math and like, I don't think any of us do.
Yeah.
In terms of the incremental leverage or risk take on each dollar of Stretch. But do we agree that that's true, that each dollar, if we assume a level price of Bitcoin, because that's really important, right? I mean, if Bitcoin goes to $1 million this year,
we're all good.
Then the ratios change a lot.
I think nobody would debate it. They're worried about the case where Bitcoin
stays flat. Stays down.
Let's just say, so for all these arguments, let's say Bitcoin stays flat for the many years. Do you agree that with each dollar of Stretch issued, that it does increase risk to repay?
For sure.
Yes.
Like indefinitely.
I don't think it's constant.
Yes.
I think it depends. Like, because what DK is describing is he has multiple different tools in the toolbox. And I think different tools at different times and collateralization ratios have different risk profiles associated. So as an example, issuing common equity, like an ATM common equity issuance, depending on what the MNAV is, you know, that greatly varies the risk profile versus selling Bitcoin at a certain price.
I agree with that as well. So it increases the risk that can vary, and it could even like dip or it could change where it's not more risk. I guess it would. Yeah, I think it's always adding more risk. It would just be less or more. Okay. And so then the question is, what's the math? I mean, can it add 20 more billion? I mean, I don't know the answer to that because what's the math? And also, not only what's the math, but like, we don't understand the demand profile. Like those new buyers, what's going into their decision to buy? If you're like Wall Street person, analytical, get spreadsheets, you're looking at all this stuff, then you're going to be like well equipped. You're going to have, we still don't know the answer, but that type of person is going to look at all this data, look at the risk, make a decision. Like retail folks, or even like
vibes.
The PB Treasury owns some Stretch.
Mm.
Alex, do you analyze the risk of every dollar you buy of Stretch? I'm guessing no.
and
that's not, and it's not because
Alex,
like,
is a business school guy. Of course he does. He's got a
spreadsheet. He's an MBA.
Yeah.
Mr. Sophisticated. So, no, I mean, like, sophisticated people on, like, small scale, probably aren't going to do that analysis. And then retail a lot would not either.
There's
different types of buyers. So you'd have to completely analyze all the different types of buyers, how big each of those categories are, right. What kind of analysis they do, and risk acceptance.
Well, but I think it's super important. So I just want to finish this thought.
Just one more thing. One more thing. Also, like, if you're, what are your time horizons?
Right.
Like, if I only intend to own Stretch for like 4 years, like let's say I know I'm going to make a big purchase in 18 months.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I own Bitcoin. And then it's like, I worry about it dipping or not growing in the next 18 months, right? Just uncertainty of that. I might put that in Stretch. And then I know I can match my liability in 18 months and get some mm-hmm. extra money. And then the risks of Strategy not paying it off in 8 years, I don't care about.
Right.
Okay. So high level, I think there's really three things to discuss, but there's two implicit in what you're saying there. One question is, will there be market demand? The other question is, can he continue to keep will there be market demand at current rates? Second question is, can he keep paying those rates?
And I want to pause on that market demand thing. Can we?
we
can pick that up.
Please, yes.
Well, I want to address it.
We're both interrupting. Yeah, I like it.
Push it on the stack. Push it on the stack.
Keep stacking.
So keep stacking. Stack Stretch. So a couple points on the retail.
Yeah.
I don't want to misrepresent or misquote, but I did watch that the earnings. The portion of the earnings call at about 3 a.m. So it might be a little foggy. This is like my bedtime, you know.
He dumped everything in the Stretch. So maybe a bad decision.
He smashed on his phone.
Did he smash?
And I seem to... I smashing at 3 a.m. I seem to recall, I think he said that 80% of Stretch demand is retail. That it's not really an institutional product today. So you're talking about sophisticated buyers and I think the hope is to get there. But I think he said that it's 80% retail phenomenon.
Yes.
And that's sort of one data point. Another data point, just anecdotal, but from my own experience, I was on the phone catching up with a friend who runs a successful e-commerce, $100 million e-commerce business. And I was telling him about it. He's like, hey, have you seen the Stretch thing? And he'd never heard of it. And he looks, he's like, 11.5%? Of course I'm going to put that, my treasury. I didn't even know this thing existed. And I think Saylor makes the claim that it's that kind of Stretch is going viral. And I just anecdotally participated in that, not intentionally. I wasn't calling him to pitch him on an investment idea. I was just, catching up with him and happened to mention it offhand. And he was like, that's crazy. Of course I want that.
Yes.
So two data points. I think this is Stretch is mostly a retail phenomenon for now. And
I think
they're doing things to try to make it, dress it up or, gussy it up for institutional appetite more.
Lipstick on there.
Anyway, so those are the two retail anecdotes I just wanted to share.
Do you have something? You're not really participating, Max.
Steve, anything you want to add to that? No, I mean, look, I just think high level from the demand side and the supply side. On the demand side, everything you're saying is just the tip of the iceberg. And of course there is demand. Like, this is the greatest financial product to ever exist. It's like, I'm going to give you 11.5% free money. All you have to believe is that 6x over-collateralized Bitcoin that's not going to crash like 80% and stay there for years. That's all you have to believe. So as long as you're like not like super, like Peter Schiff, probably not a product for him.
Hold on. I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to challenge that because like we just said, for every new dollar in to Stretch, it adds risk, and that adds risk for everyone.
Yes.
It adds risk of them being able to pay dividends. So yes. there is more risk.
So my point for that was at current rates and current risk. Okay. So assume he can keep paying 11.5% and he keeps over collateralization at 5 to 6x or whatever it is. Okay. Now, as he continues to add on more and the risk changes and presumably the interest rate that he would be able to pay changes as well, I'm guessing. Now, then the question becomes, and this to me is a much better question, because again, one more thing I want to stress is this, I've seen this retail phenomenon too, and I've seen with my portfolio companies. Like, I told all of them that are like sort of exchanges and like regional banks, I was like, guys, why don't you just create a stable coin you get 11.5% from Stretch, you pocket 4 or 3%.
You talked about that. Did you catch that part of
Hell
that?
Hell yeah, I caught that. Yeah. Like, but we've been on this journey for 8 months. And so I hope that little extra inside alpha gives them the push. But literally every single one of them, I had one founder email me back and was like, I couldn't sleep for 2 nights. Like, I can't stop thinking about this idea. Like the demand is going to be there, and that's just retail. That I'm serious.
I have another comment.
but one last thing on this. That doesn't even get into the institutional. And my point on the institutional is, like, you know, we also, our mutual friend who's in this is not, he's not a highly regard like us. Like, he's super smart. He does the numbers. He loves this product. And like, yes, we're going to need ratings agencies. It's like, of course, like, you need the old, like, old people need old things. And like, it's you know, it's that, that tweet.
Yes. Yeah, he like extra glance my way.
It reminds me of, do you guys remember that tweet? That like, it showed like Bitcoin ownership by Myers-Briggs type.
Yeah.
It was like literally like 80 to 90. Like, if you are ENTJ, ENTP, INTJ, INTP, you own Bitcoin. If you're not an N, you don't. It's like literally that simple. And the S's are going to need BlackRock and everyone to come in and say this is legit. But the N's are already all there. The N's are going to jump to Stretch really, really easily. So N's, all good. That's how we get to the institutional phase. So, okay. So I'll just pause there and say, in my mind, until this thing eats the treasury market, which is where it's headed, there will be infinite demand.
The other lever he has is he can reduce the yield. Like,
he talks about that in the call.
Okay, but we haven't talked about it. Right. And I don't even think we talked about it in our chat with our friend. Mm-hmm. But like, if demand is so high that there's risk of selling Stretch to all of them and then can't.
Left.
All right. Well, we're back, or maybe we're never left. But anyway, yeah, I mean, he can just simply lower the yield. That'll reduce demand. And then it reduces obligations. And he has tons of levers.
It's like any new product, you kind of need to create a vortex of attention in the market. And 11.5% creates that vortex of attention.
Exactly.
He even models out in the earnings call. He has a thing that shows it kind of potentially stepping down, I think, over 20 years to maybe 6%.
That makes total sense. To me, the end state here is that it does compete with and replace the treasure, the money markets.
Yep.
And that doesn't happen in 2026. It happens over decades.
Yes. And if you start with the money market today, people are like, whatever, I already got a money market. Yeah. Why get involved with all this other stuff?
Yeah.
You need to have a more attractive value.
But over decades, it can get there, and then the rates will come down to whatever the risk-free rate is of the future. And we've talked about, you know, it could be the lightning yield or various like cold storage, self-custody Bitcoin yield products, which Lightning already exists, and there's others that are concepts that might become a reality, and who knows what the future will hold. But that's like super low risk. I mean, if you're self-custodying your Bitcoin in cold storage, that's and you're earning yield off of that because you've time locked it. That's super powerful. So if that becomes popular in products, I can imagine that being a risk-free rate.
Yeah, I agree.
And yeah, so I think the Stretch will ultimately offer that rate.
I agree.
Trillions of dollars
over many decades now. If I put on my more skeptic hat, I think it is important to understand what are his limitations. Like, we're obviously fans, but like, let's do this justice and play devil's advocate. So the thing I just totally disagree with our friend on is that the demand's going to be there like that. I don't buy it all. What I do agree with is, will he be able to offer that attractive product that gets all the way up to the risk-free rate of return to supply the demand? Like, I think there's going to be way more demand than he can supply unless he figures something out. So to be clear, up until this earnings call that you shared, my understanding was, with the way I understood his levers, like, yes, he could, and he can even not pay for a month and then it like accrues and backs up. Like, he's so many different levers. But his principal one was, he sells Stretch, he takes that money, he has this cash reserve, but it's unclear if he's actually filling the cash reserve. So like, let's just leave that aside for a minute. But he sells Stretch, and then he basically sells MicroStrategy at the market. And if he has,
not that much these days, right?
Well, this is my understanding up until this call. And so he could sell MicroStrategy at the market to pay the Stretch dividends. And, you know, if the MNAV was above one, then that's like a positive trade that increases Bitcoin per share. If it's below one, that's a negative trade, so you shouldn't do it. Okay. So to me, the limiting factor was, is there going to be Bitcoin price appreciation and or new demand for MicroStrategy, not Stretch, critically MicroStrategy? Now, one way you get more demand for MicroStrategy is Bitcoin price goes up, people start FOMOing in, okay? Or the other thing is, and I think this is another giant unexplored growth vector, is just to your, the same point, your friend didn't even know what Stretch is. Well, now that he knows Stretch, he's going to start reading more. He's gonna be like, what the hell is this company behind it? Oh shit, if I'm bullish on Stretch, maybe I want to own the underlying asset. So I think there's like a positive virtuous cycle as well, where I think, you know, recently, you know, in the last year, certainly, you're starting to see more big players, including central banks, that are dipping their toes into Bitcoin, some through ETFs, but critically many through MicroStrategy. I think the Swiss National Bank, even the Canadian Federal whatever bank, whatever it's called, the Federal Reserve Light, the
Burtons.
Yeah, the maple syrup version. Those guys are also buying MicroStrategy. So you're starting to see more institutions come in and get comfortable with it, but they're still to the tunes of just like, you know, whatever, $100, $200 million. That's going to scale over time. So I think there's a lot of untapped demand just in terms of market awareness and comfort with MicroStrategy, and untapped potential in terms of like actual growth because of Bitcoin price appreciation. Those are all different levers. But at some point, my concern was, you know, until we, you know, start ripping in a bull, there will be at least temporary limits on how much Stretch he can offer is based on MicroStrategy demand. However, after listening to this call yesterday, and I don't understand it well enough to do it justice, but if he can start selling Bitcoin and has other levers, then what he claimed is basically he doesn't even need those things to happen. He can just sell Bitcoin. And he's like, oh, you know, land company, if you buy it for 10K and sell it for 100K, that's a great deal. And I could use it to buy more Bitcoin. And that kind of makes sense to me. I need to actually go and run the numbers, but it seems like he's more bullish. There's more bullish scenarios than I had given him credit for until today.
Our Canadian friend says it's called the Bank of Canada.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Matt. yeah, whatever. Soon to be the Bank of America, I heard. But anyways, the other thing I'll mention, though, is if I want to do this super justice and be fair, if I want to put on my super skeptic hat, I'm just going to throw a comment out. I'm curious how you guys react to it. I have my own answer for why it's different. But at some level, you know, you could say, what's the difference between MicroStrategy and Terra Luna?
I did some LLMing on this, yeah.
And I want to give one piece of context, and I'm curious how you would answer that. But obviously, he has many more levers. He has much deeper capital markets. That's probably a bunch of the answer. He's not like some like rando, you know, South Korean dude that can just dump. He has like board governance and like there's like some guardrails. But I also think this is important because we debated this a bit in the chat yesterday because, you know, we talked about, is it a Ponzi? Is it a not Ponzi? Like, depends on how you define Ponzi. To me, nothing is a Ponzi if you have the collateral to meet your obligations. So to be clear, if the only way you can meet your obligations is I sell new Stretch to pay old Stretch, then you're Bernie Madoff. If you sell new Stretch and use that to pay old Stretch, but you also have over collateralization that you could have used, then that's not a Ponzi. And to be clear, by that definition, banking is a radical Ponzi because you're 10% of, or 20%, whatever it is, whereas MicroStrategy is 600%.
Protected by the government and taxpayers, right? And that's why I forget all the details of how Terra Luna fell apart, but my guess was that like with Strategy, if there was like some kind of run on it, I mean, it's centralized and controlled. They can like stop things. They're more in control.
There's a very important detail.
With like the Terra Luna blockchain, like who's going to stop
that? There's a very important detail here. There's no security that will redeem into Bitcoin. As a holder of MSTR, you can't be like, I demand my Bitcoin per share.
Yeah.
It's not possible. That's a massive difference.
Yeah.
With Terra Luna, and I wasn't a super student of Terra Luna when it happened, but with Terra Luna,
we have a friend who does understand the mechanics very well, so we can LLM in if we want to learn more.
Phone a friend.
But I think the fact that you can't redeem the underlying asset is actually a bit of it radically changes, I think, the structure of it. It has some similar convexity that Terra Luna had, but I think it's a very different beast. And yeah, like you said, there's a bunch of other regulatory layers and reporting layers and stuff. So yeah, I think it's not that, again, there are risks and problems, but I don't think that's one of them. Yeah,
everything I understand about Strategy, it's not a Ponzi scheme. It's not a scam. It requires you to believe that Bitcoin's going to appreciate substantially over a long period of time.
He has a nice chart where he breaks that down too. Like if you believe that it's going to be, you know, whatever, 40% or 30% CAGR going forward, then here's how you think about it. If you think it's going to be zero, here's how you think about it. If you think it's going to be negative, here's how you think about it. And you can actually see, like, if you think it's going to be negative, you should not.
Yeah, this falls apart.
You should
apart.
Not trust this. It does fall apart. So if you think it's going to be negative, you have reasons to not be involved with this and to kind of hate it and to talk badly about it. Like, you should be aware that Bitcoin can go down. It could stay down for a long time. I don't think it's going to stay down for like 5 years, but like it could, right? And that would be one mechanism that could cause it to fall apart. But if it's, you know, I'm not a 4-year cycle guy, but like if it's 4-year cycle or stays flat for a year or two and then it pops again and then it stays flat, like any of those scenarios, it's actually pretty safe.
Yeah. Have we talked enough about strategy?
We didn't talk about selling Bitcoin. That was the news.
You drugged them again.
So is this like major news? Is it scary? Like, are all his fans going to desert him because he's talking about selling Bitcoin?
He came out. He was famous for coming out and saying, "You never sell your Bitcoin."
Yeah.
And now he's saying, "Actually, we want to be able to sell our Bitcoin." Pay no attention to that. No, I think it's actually it was described well in our other chat as just like part of the toolkit. Like, why restrict yourself? Like, if you present yourself as like, hey, we will never sell the Bitcoin, that opens up all kinds of opportunities for arbitrageurs to come in and try to optimize the situation because they know that you will not sell your Bitcoin. If you say, hey, I might sell the Bitcoin from time to time if I feel like it, and I'm going to test it. I haven't read it yet. So
don't worry, I'll tell you.
We're talking about another.
It's a side threat.
But if you have the ability, the tool, and you can, if you say, look, arbitrageur, you want to do something, I actually can sell my Bitcoin. So I'm going to reduce the ability for you to take that arb, which is going to put more value back to the MSTR stock value.
Yeah. I think it's unquestionably a rational move. It strengthens their position. It reduces the risk of it all falling apart, which reduces the risk of Bitcoin being harmed by it all falling apart. So,
and my understanding is to get inclusion in the S&P 500. I think Standard & Poor gave them, I don't know if this is totally related, Standard & Poor Global gave them some advice or some letter that said things like, you know, we're worried about the fact that you will never sell Bitcoin. Like, that's a problem. And I think actually retiring some of the convertible debt can help with some of the potential inclusion stuff. So I think it's just rational. Like, why handcuff yourself just for like ideological sake? Like, own the ability, own the toolkit. And then use the toolkit to the best of your abilities, what the market meets.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Not worried about it.
Not worried about it.
Yeah. Okay, so do we've officially...
Well, I want to answer one question from Matt, which is, how does Max Hydration Mog DK and Steve so hard every single episode? Well, there's a much deeper threat on that
this moment
than you knew, Matt. Although, actually, I'm not mogging DK as hard. Steve, you got to step up your hydration game. Like, I actually have been going through all kinds of weird hydration issues. So I need a lot of hydration. But
You've always been, though, haven't you?
I have. And that's part of this investigation into a variety of health things that have been going on for me, which I won't get into now. But it's all about hydration. but yeah, I mean, I would love to see my dear friends hydrated as well. So Steve, we'll bring you some.
I've hydrated very well this morning.
Okay.
You know what I've gotten into recently? Do you guys ever do electrolyte tabs in your...
Elements.
Element-y?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I love that stuff. I got into that, maybe a month or two ago, I got into that. Now I actually take Pellegrinos and I crush up those little...
Smash them?
Yeah, I smash them. Let's say it. I smash up those things and I drop them in my Pellegrinos now too. So
nice.
I'm very hydrated and very electrolyted.
By the way, it's kind of weird though, because I feel like I never heard of people doing electrolytes like even a year ago. And now every single person I talk to is like, oh yeah, I'm hooked on Element D.
Like, I mean, like,
what happened?
Triathletes, you know, it's like part of the culture.
No, I'm a little skeptical. I think if you're doing like endurance events and it's hot, very hot, then it's an enormous win.
Yeah.
But as like a daily tablet, if you eat a balanced diet, you probably are going to be okay.
Well, I think that probably is the implicit issue, is that most of America is not eating a balanced diet. And also, even if you are, something I will say is a little alpha drop. One of the things that changed my life the most over the last several years is taking magnesium at night. So much deeper. Like, it's very noticeable. And my kind of running thesis is, in fact, when I did a little Ideas from the Edge like a year or two ago with Lynn Alden, and you know, most people ask Lynn about things like geopolitics and stuff, and I was more curious about her her nutrition habits. Yeah, she was great. Because she was talking about sardines and electrolytes. It was very interesting. You should listen. But she's the one that got me turned on to magnesium, and it's been life-changing. And when I start going in that rabbit hole, I think the TLDR is that one, people probably aren't eating enough vegetables, gotten magnesium in the first place. But even if you are, sadly, with like factory farming and the whole fiat mess in which we live, our soils have been so depleted that you're missing some of these basic things that, you know, our grandparents 100 years ago would have gotten from eating spinach.
I see.
Are you guys psyllium husk maxis too?
What do you know what that is?
Okay.
What's a psyllium husk?
It's a powder you can put in like yogurt or something. And
what does it do?
It's think of it like it's just extremely high fiber, or some people call it organic GLP-1.
So you're like microdosing fiber.
Yeah, it's good for lowering your cholesterol and stuff. Yeah, we kind of got into it a few weeks ago, just trying it out.
Okay.
This is the group of guys I rode bikes with this morning.
They're into it.
It was this conversation times 10.
Right. But
I'm getting overwhelmed by this conversation.
Well, gentlemen, as I continue moving to the PBJ retirement home, I'll have to start exploring my fiber.
Metamucil.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
They were also talking about some group, I think it was in the area, it's all about like self-growth and stuff, but you have to be 55 years old to, that's the minimum age.
Minimum age to qualify. Group.
So yeah. I'm maybe soon. Looking forward to that.
See you guys in a couple of decades.
Yeah. I'll let you know how it goes.
Vitality.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about your recent vibe coding project?
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, it's way more substantial than a lot of the vibe coded stuff. And that's not to diminish the other cool stuff you, Matt, and others have been building and Max. But this is like a just more in-depth type of, or I mean, like if it's successful, it would literally be world changing.
it's more protocol level than just.
And it's protocol level, it's so why don't you tell us about what it is and like your process, the evolution of it.
Yeah. So, well, we've talked before, and you know, we've talked about this names project, you know, alluded to it over the years, and I had done writing and shared it privately and gotten feedback and stuff, and we've sort of been trying to noodle on this. The core thing that has bothered me is that like DNS is captured. It has layers of control around it. And so if you want to visit a website or if you have a payment tied to a DNS address, that payment could be censored. If you try to visit a website and get information, that information could be censored. And just, you know, kind of the deeper I've gotten into Bitcoin, the more that I think everything should be more free and available and censored. Like I don't think you can trust whoever currently holds the power to look out for you. You have to sort of empower people with cryptography. And so that's sort of like a basic principle that I've gotten very, very passionate about through Bitcoin, and now it extends far beyond Bitcoin.
When you say naming, what do you mean by naming?
Naming. So if you want to go visit a website, you want to go visit, you know, www.google.com, you're dependent on the .com top level domain and ICANN and Cloudflare, and there's a bunch of different layers in there. And if for some reason somebody said, hey, we're going to call up the CEO of company X and tell them we're not going to serve that domain anymore, and when you try to access google.com, then your browser would just say, sorry, nothing there.
And maybe go a little bit deeper on that. So explain maybe DNS a bit more if people don't know. Domain naming system? And so how exactly, so if I type in www.google.com, where does that bounce? Like how does Cloudflare involve? How does ICANN involve? And what exactly, and I don't even know this. Who created ICANN? Like who gave them power?
I don't know all the history exactly. It's some sort of loose affiliation. I think it's not super commercial oriented. You know, it's kind of early internet, just some sort of loose affiliation of how you get stuff rooted around. So I don't know all the details of where that came from. Do you?
Steve knows.
No, I was just saying, Rob Hamilton's in the house. So, hey, Rob, been a while.
Oh, hey.
And would love his, I bet he's interested in this topic.
Oh,
yeah, cool.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your feedback, Rob.
By the way, you started with the like censorship angle, but what about the angle that I think might resonate with more people? And that's, you know, today I might have email, at gmail.com.
Yeah.
Or when it comes to like a human readable address for receiving money, it might be at Cash App.
Yep.
Cash.app or whatever. But then if I move wallets, or if that service provider goes bankrupt or disappears or shuts the service down, well, then I've lost my name.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't it be great to have a global name that I own for life and it works across vendors?
Yeah.
To me, that's like, that will resonate with 1,000 times more humans than censorship resistance. Sure. And it'll also apply to 1,000 times more humans. And that's not because I'm dismissing the value of censorship resistance. I just think it's a more impactful marketing angle for it.
And I would say even an example that's even more common, at least for me, is like, say there's domains I bought because I was like, oh, I have an idea for this in the future. And then I just forget to renew them, which actually happened recently. It's like, oh shit, now someone else can go and grab that. I would much rather know I can buy this outright and it's mine.
I just want to confirm that that's accurate, right?
Yes.
That's a value proposition.
I was just sharing kind of the motivation or kind of how I came to get passionate about this problem. But yeah, I think just generally having, you know, on the internet, we get very comfortable having like, you know, my name at Gmail. And then if for some reason Gmail doesn't do what you want, all of your people that for many years you've used it, they are reaching to that domain to reach you. And if that domain says, sorry, we're not relaying those messages, we're closing your account or something, you have no way to communicate to them and be like, hey, I got moved, I'm over here instead. There's no way to do that because all of the, like, you know, Gmail is a major hub of, it's a major control point. I don't think there's a lot of evidence of them doing bad things in the past, but that's just one example. And then I think like payments, like you mentioned, you know, Cash App, like you could get a call, a tap on the, you know, shoulder from somebody who is in power at the moment. You may not agree with anymore, but now they have the ability to call you up and tell you, hey, don't accept payments, don't allow payments. So I just don't like the idea of all those control things. That's what sort of drives my passion to focus on this. But I do think it has very simple real world problems. Like you lose a domain, you know, most domains you're paying rent to somebody. In most names, if you have an Instagram handle, that's a name. But if Instagram doesn't like you or they need to reclaim your name and give it to somebody else because there's some celebrity who has the same name, they sometimes do stuff like that that's a little haphazard. And I just think names are so important for how we represent ourselves, how we connect and communicate and pay and just find information and verify that we're getting the information or we're sending the payment or receiving the payment. I think names are just the way that we're going to interact with the internet.
Just one other thought I had. There's the company banned you because they don't like you, but there's the company goes bankrupt or shuts the service down. But there's also the company doesn't ban you. They are still operating, but they kind of go out of style. Like when you, like the past 20 years, if someone sends you an email, like from Hotmail,
right. Totally going to respond.
You literally lose respect for that person.
AOL.com.
Right. And so like, I feel like if I have a name that I truly own and it's like tied to the Bitcoin blockchain, not in any way tied to anyone else's brand. I mean, it's tied to my brand or whatever I choose as the name. But I'm in control of that reputation that it'll endure more over time.
Right. Yeah. Yep. And it should be, I think of it as it should be as good as like, if you can own a UTXO sovereignly and that's yours and it just sits there, and you don't have to pay a bank a fee to keep your account open or anything. I feel like names should be that same way, where you can own a name and you don't have to pay an annual registration fee, or you don't have to log in every 90 days, or you're like, you can go away for a decade and come back and your name is still there and you still own it as long as you control the keys that control the name. You know, similar to sort of
unless they've been seized because of the quantum concern.
I mean, another way to just phrase what you're saying is like, you know, if you want sovereign individual or thesis to play out, or like if you want sovereignty on the internet, if you want the ability to own property on the internet, naming is critical for that. And if you don't have that, then you're effectively, you know, a sharecropper on, you know, a fiefdom.
Actually, another one that came up, we were talking email a bit, it just came up recently. If you sort of think about even just if you wanted to create a messenger that everybody could use that's open source, that you can verify and you don't have servers in the middle. And there's a few projects like BitChat, White Noise, Simplex. Like if those services exist, but it's always hard. You can't just like type your phone number in and get a code to verify who you are so you can recover your account later. Like, if you go through that process, like you can with Signal, but then they have the server problem. Like, so you can't actually do a a fully reproducible build style software package, open source, that runs messaging. You can't do that unless you, the current is like the app stores and stuff don't let you do that. But if you do that, if it's like, here's a GitHub repo, go build your messenger from open source, like that thing is not going to know, how does it issue names?
Yeah.
So when you do that, then you have to, well, here's my crazy 64 character code, copy paste this thing.
And I think it's important because, I mean, you know, we've all been Nostrables for a long time. Yeah. We used to talk about this all the time on Nostr News back in the day. Is like the hope with Nostr. Nostr obviously is just all private key pairs, your identity, which is great as a starting point. I mean, but then you want it to be tied to something human readable and for agents as well. But like the whole promise of Nostr, which I still very much believe in, I think is still very relevant here, is that you have interoperability and you break down silos, right? Which frees commerce, frees information, all kinds of good things come from that. But like, put all aside all the censorship resistance stuff, like one, I think, very concrete problem, and I think we should discuss about what this means for agents too, because that's going to be a whole new playing field. But even just the legacy systems, right? Like, anyone listening to this chat, imagine how much do you hate that, like, you have Slack and some people are on Slack. You have WhatsApp and some people are on WhatsApp. You have SMS and some people are on SMS. Yep. You have Signal and some people are on, and then someone's like, oh, can I send you a message on Telegram? Like, as a policy, I've just started shutting these apps down and be like, sorry, I don't use it. Like, you can either message me where I am or we don't talk. Like, I'm done. I'm sick of 15 notifications and constantly DDoSing my attention. But if you have an open source name, then you can choose whatever. Like, you could use Slack and I can use Signal, or you could use WhatsApp and I could use SMS. Like that to me is a problem that everyone will relate to. And I think is actually critical, not only for sovereignty and the sense of ownership, but also just like attention sovereignty. Because I think our current system, whether designed that way or not, is a DDoS attack on what matters.
So we've set the stage. What have you, because you've been thinking about this, working on and off for 3 years or something like that.
Yeah, right? Forever. Yeah.
But it's had like, you've had renewed energy this year, I think. And I've been following along closer than, I've always liked the idea of this, but I've been following closer and closer. I'm still like, and now 200 messages behind on the latest feedback. So I'm not quite at the tip.
There's a lot going on there.
It's looking promising. Like I'm pretty convinced you have a solution. Do you want to describe it?
Yeah, I can talk about the kind of the important principles that may unlock this to be a good solution. So one thing that has been problematic is if you want to have a namespace, it's hard to figure out how do you allocate the names. Do the early people just take all the good ones and then...
Which is what Vinny just raised right here, is that basically if you're not rich, like you could just get like locked out.
Yep. So you either have that or you have a central provider who issues the names and then you're dealing with like paying them and then they can turn you off or reallocate. And I think we there's like prior art and things like there's a Ethereum project called ENS that kind of had a moment, but it suffers from a lot of those types of problems where... you know, there's like a DAO that actually ultimately gets to decide, and they charge you annual rent, and they end up issuing them. So the core idea here is you need to, in a sense, like Bitcoin is an asset without an issuer.
Bearer asset.
You need a bearer instrument, and you need it to be without an issuer. Mm-hmm. So you can't be like, hey, I'm not going to issue them. I just want to help establish a protocol so that people can self-issue.
Right.
So how do you self-issue while not making the whole namespace easily crappable or polluted? Well, I think a bond is a good solution to that because a bond has a time value to it. Like if you bond some value for a certain period of time, you say, I agree to not use the liquidity of that. I'm going to take a liquid asset and I'm going to make it illiquid. And that costs me. It's costly to do that. And if you're doing it with Bitcoin, there's a limited supply of it. So you can't just grab everything. You have to kind of make choices about, hey, this is important to me. This one I'm okay not having. So it forces that kind of decision in everybody's head. So the core principle of this is instead of paying a third party to issue, everybody self-issues, and they do so by posting a bond in Bitcoin. And then, you know, we've come to the conclusion that probably an auction is a good way to make sure that, you know, salient brands in the world can get bid up to a reasonable shot so that somebody who has a ton of Bitcoin can't still recreate the problem. The problem kind of gets somewhat mitigated by the fact that you get auctions that competitive auction dynamics that help price the bonds.
Like two levels. I mean, Vinny brings up the problem is if it's free. Well, of course, if it's free, then whoever's like an early adopter or including the creator of it would literally just take every name in the universe. And then it would obviously go nowhere. No one else would value the system. okay, well, then you can charge or you can have a bond like DK just said. There's still a concern, though. Like, do we know anyone who has a history of squatting, name squatting, and who has hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin to their disposal? Right. So,
first name Miguel.
A concern was that, well, take the top like 100,000 brands in the world, and at least the kind of bond prices that you were contemplating, someone with hundreds of thousands of Bitcoin could, I mean, let's say the bond is one BTC per name. If you have 100,000 BTC, you can lock up the top 100,000 names. And if you're early, you can do that. So that's a problem too. Because again, it just simply wouldn't take off. Like people, it wouldn't be credible.
Yeah.
So that's where the auction comes into play. Mm-hmm. And I think the only necessary ingredient is that you have a minimum of two greedy speculators because they will bid up the price such that it would be impossible to buy up the top 100,000 names. It's still possible that a greedy speculator could buy Google or something, but pay
somebody else is going to
much more substantial price so that in the future, when the system does become popular and then all of a sudden Google's like, oh, this is actually a serious system. I need to be on it. They're going to have to pay market value, but the person who bought it paid a fairly high starting point.
Like they could
still profit, but they're just unable to acquire like the world's global brand.
And to be clear, like when we say greedy speculator, like, I mean, they're just being smart. I think it's great that there's like speculative pieces of this. That's what's going to drive adoption of Bitcoin. But the key thing is, like you said, it needs to be credibly neutral or as close to credibly neutral and fair as possible. And in the same way that Bitcoin, unlike every other shitcoin and cryptocurrency that's ever been out there, nothing was ever issued for free, not even to Satoshi. There was always an exchange of proof of work, always a computational cycle or electricity cost for every Bitcoin that was issued. Same thing here.
Yeah. And this is trying to actually just ride on all the electricity cost of Bitcoin is not creating its own. Actually, Satoshi, do you guys know the BitDNS thing, right? Satoshi had tried to help with a project. It was originally called BitDNS, I think, and then it became called Namecoin. If you may know the name Namecoin.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
So that was something that they did like this merge mining, and they had a separate proof of work.
Oh, interesting.
Was trying to sort of...
Bad idea.
But I think this, in a sense, is an evolution. I don't want to call it an evolution, but it's like an extension or a divergence from that core idea. Instead of merge mining, just say Bitcoin won proof of work. We all believe Bitcoin won proof of work. I think it's winner take all. There should not be another mining process, but you can take advantage of the proof of work and the limited supply of Bitcoin to force owners of Bitcoin to make allocation decisions.
Yeah.
Forcing allocation decisions is really what's important in a new namespace.
And if you think about, I mean, this is a debate that we used to have like on Nostr a lot. Like some people wanted to have like certain relays where you had to do some sort of like hash cash or proof of work system. And my point was always just do a Lightning payment or a Bitcoin payment. Cause like, it's like, I agree with you. I think there is a winner take all for, if you think about what Bitcoin is in a lot of ways, it's converting. I've said this before, but it's opening a portal between the digital or the mental realm and the physical realm, right? It's basically saying it's taking this real proof of work or energy cost to create something represented in the digital. It's a really, really big idea that I think people will still be understanding the implications of for decades or centuries to come. And for this, and for anything, I think you only do that once. You don't need another mechanism to do that. So what I was going to say is in the way that Saylor talks about this, right? Like if Bitcoin is digital capital, which is conversion of raw physical energy into a digital representation of that, digital token tied to the energy, it's not energy itself, obviously, then he's creating what he calls distilling to digital credit. I mean, this is another way of distilling digital capital into digital land, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So, we sort of highlighted the opportunity, high level, what the design, the challenges and how they've been overcome. But what I think's the most amazing part is we're not just talking.
Yeah.
Like you've built the system and it's working, right?
Right, yeah.
Which is truly incredible because like a few years ago when we were talking about this, your knowledge of Bitcoin overall is quite strong. But what, like technical details, relatively weaker.
Yeah.
But even you'd ask me questions, I actually wasn't really sure either. And I have a stronger technical background in Bitcoin. So we didn't really have answers. And now with the advent of vibe coding LLMs, you've built a working system without really having to like go, you didn't go off and study Bitcoin technical stuff for 2 years.
Right.
But you're able to, you know, ask smart questions and overcome, you use AI to help overcome problems. And so tell us about what's that process been look like and what exists today.
Yeah. So, I had sort of written a lot about, it's kind of like I'd written a lot about this over the course of years. And I even got really passionate about trying to get deeper into the Bitcoin technical details that I'm not as familiar with. But I'd spent some time with a few of our friends and trying to sort of find other people who already had that Bitcoin technical depth to see if I could get them excited and inspire them and sort of get like a thought partner on that. And I think I found a few people at least who had some real passion around it, but were otherwise busy with stuff. And, you know, life's busy, it's fine. I was actually in the Flint community, and there was another project launched maybe as a few months ago now that was launched out of the Flint community that was using OpReturn in a new way. And I just, you know, submitted a new project and I was talking about it. And then I was explaining the kinds of things that I thought could be done or should be done. And then I was like, you know, I think the tools have gotten a lot better. Maybe I should take all my previous writing and dump it into, you know, latest tools. I forget if I used Claude initially. No, I think I was using Codex at that point. So I dumped it into Codex and that became my brainstorm partner. And that actually, it has extreme depth on all Bitcoin technical details. Really understands the trade-offs well. It was really remarkable to be able to take what's, I'd call it effectively a systems or an economic idea, but not a technical. I wasn't trying to come up with a technical innovation. I was trying to come up with like an economic or a systems innovation. And it was filling in the gaps on all the technical questions and raising what, you know, if we do it like this, it's going to be that. If we do it like that, it's going to be that. So I've been delighted to both have it. I mean, initially it was just like, hey, brainstorm partner. I was like, wow, it really understands what I'm doing. And I'd played with Bitcoin related ideas maybe, you know, 9 months ago that it felt like it never really quite got it and didn't understand. Like I understood the trade-offs better than it understood. Now with Codex, I'm like, wow, this understands the trade-offs and it's taking me places that I've wanted to be pushed. So I think it's just a game changer. The moment we're in as an individual, I don't think I could have done this all without the LLMs. And in a sense, it's an LLM, the moment that LLMs have enabled for me.
It's amazing.
Super cool. Super cool.
What code is it producing? Like what language?
Good question. I don't really.
That's part of the response.
That's part of the sales pitch.
Yeah, I don't read the code. I guess I don't read the code. I don't find it important to read. I don't know what I would read because it all goes by. So actually, it's TypeScript. Now that I think about it, okay. I do watch it, and it's TypeScript, but like I don't read it much. You know.
In this, describe how this works. So this code, who's running this code? On what types of computers? Why would they run this code?
Yeah. So the basic structure of the system is that we want to be very parsimonious about using Bitcoin block space. And so the only thing that actually gets written to Bitcoin is effectively like the name and like a small hash code, right? And that can then be taken to prove that you own that name. But all of the like, what do you do with the name? What does it map to? You know, key value pairs and stuff. That all happens on a separate type of system we're calling resolvers. And the resolvers actually can be run by anybody. It's also an open source piece of software, but kind of functions like a server. I'm running one. Anybody's welcome to run them. They're not meant to be like, you know, they're centralized for now, but they're designed to be like anybody can run it. Any people can run them. And
how do you choose which resolver like actually resolves?
Yeah, there's we've been discussing. Well, I use we a lot. Codex and I've been discussing
his AI friend.
You know, I think there's an important property here, which is resolvers are always resolving from data that's visible publicly on Bitcoin. And so you can always say, hey, I heard about a new resolver. Is it good? I can be like, well, if I look at everything happening on Bitcoin, I can say that this resolver is actually quite a good resolver. It has all the up-to-date information that can be had. But you could imagine a future where you want to actually have some sort of a resolver discovery protocol. And I suggested, you know, like when you first run a Bitcoin full node, you kind of have the block discovery problem. What's it called? The block bootstrapping moment?
Initial download.
Initial block download, IBD, mm-hmm. right? There's like, to do that, you have to figure out who else has them. And I think there's even maybe some seeded IP addresses or... So probably something like that would be a reasonable way. And it's a less critical problem than Bitcoin has already solved in that case. So I think you can use some mechanism for saying, hey, look, I'm going to run one. If you want to run one, you can. It's cheap to run. Anybody can run them. But that's a separate piece of software. And so there's the Bitcoin piece. There's the resolvers. And then right now I'm running it on a SIGNET. So it's like a mini version of Bitcoin or a test version of Bitcoin that I run. And to actually sign to claim a name, you have to like open an auction and claim a name. You use like the Sparrow wallet to create a partially signed Bitcoin transaction that you can then broadcast to the SIGNET network I'm running. And then you can get open an auction. And according to the auction dynamics, you can end up closing the auction. And then you control a separate private key that you can use with the resolvers to update to whatever key value pairs you want.
I have a question. Optimization question. You said that the names are embedded in the blockchain, so they're going into op return.
Yep.
Can instead, can you hash the names, and then the hash goes in the blockchain? So if you have long names, right? We'd have to do the math about like how small of hash you could use without collisions, but mm-hmm. I suspect a conservative size for a hash would be smaller than the average text string size. Mm-hmm. So that might save 50 to 90% or something. Mm-hmm. Thoughts on that? Because then, I mean, I guess the cost of that is then it's not publicly visible what the names are. But if mm-hmm. you've established a name, then I want to bid on it later. I bid on it by hashing my string, and then that would collide with what's already there. So I'd then get a message saying already taken.
Right. Well, the resolver would have already needs to already know that that's taken, right? So how you actually store it on the Bitcoin blockchain, you'd already given, I thought you were going in a different direction because you gave feedback.
I'm going to go to the next
okay.
optimization. We've already had this conversation.
That sounds reasonable. I don't have a strong opinion.
Yeah, so are you using Merkle trees and yeah. open timestamp directly or open timestamp concept?
Merkle trees, yes. I haven't done anything specifically with open timestamp, but it wouldn't surprise me if that's where Codex got.
But if each name is on embedded in the blockchain, then how are you using the Merkle tree?
No, like it's you gave this feedback on chat like a few months ago, right? So
that's why I'm surprised to now hear that every name is on the blockchain.
Well, I was trying to explain a kind of a simplified version of it, but separate from like the optimization of a single name. I actually would have to look at that optimization of a single name, but optimization of multiple names does use Merkle trees. So you can initiate auctions. I get to choose 100 names I want to initiate auctions on, post 100 bonds, to write that into a short thing that gets posted to the Bitcoin blockchain. So that is, again, very parsimonious with the usage of Bitcoin.
But is the actual name itself in the Bitcoin blockchain, or the hash? But the Merkle tree.
Merkle tree. So I assume that first question you asked mm-hmm. would also work or could be designed to work in a similar way. But if the Merkle tree thing works, that's like kind of a harder version of it, right? So it should collapse to be able to...
But then not every name is going into an op return transaction on the blockchain. So we need to add Codex to our show.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
So that we can ask.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
That's good. Actually, time.
Yeah, Alex, if we can find a way to like have like.
I mean, we're trying to add Codex to everything.
Yeah,
just Codex, when Alex thought he had this show perfectly fine tuned, we're going to add AI bots.
I have a more sort of design question, like comparison. I know you'd looked, I've seen a couple of other attempts at this. The most probably notable one was Spaces, launched a couple years ago.
Yeah.
How, I never fully understood that protocol either. How does this compare and contrast that? Because I know you like some things about that, but had questions about other parts of it.
Yeah, I'm not as up to date on it. I I looked at it more closely a few years ago, I think, when they were kind of first talking about it. A few things that I didn't like the way that you couldn't, like, if you have a name you want, like Google or Presidio Bitcoin or Max, you can't just get it. You have to sort of propose that it goes to auction. Yeah. And then they try to solve the scarcity problem by limiting the number of top level spaces that can go out at any given year. And I think it should just be more flexible.
More permissionless and flexible.
To let as many go out. And they have like a subspaces concept, which tries to solve that. But I'd rather you just be able to have a name. Just pick a name, have a name.
My other question, kind of getting to what Steve was saying a little bit, depending on how the name is broadcast, how critical is it? So for example, if you're just storing a hash and you need, I guess the resolver would still be able to check the Merkle tree to see what names are open or not. Because it seems important if you want this to be seen as credibly neutral and fair, that anyone running whatever piece of software, whether it's the resolver or whatever else, to be able to look for names. Because like you're going to see like, I guess like arbitragers or like whatever, like competitive speculists that are like, okay,
but they'd
I want
to
check.
To, right? Because I want to look for the name Max Webster or whatever. I dig the hash of that and then look it up in the table.
Yeah, so, but
dude, it's easy. It's an API call to the resolver. Just say, show me all the auctions open right now.
Okay, yeah, got it.
I think this is super exciting.
This is very promising.
I'm still just waiting for like, what's the gotcha? Because if it's not a gotcha, then this thing seems incredible. And then I guess there's still more testing and perhaps people should audit the code, humans.
I'd like at some point
don't
to get,
know what language.
Yeah.
And also maybe transfer from TypeScript to Rust. I don't know.
TypeScript, like,
I don't even
supply
know.
Supply chain attacks, like all kinds of, maybe it goes Rust.
In addition to auditing the code, I'd like other people who have more technical depth than Bitcoin to use LLMs to push on this.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's an important piece.
So I think that's a phase. And then there's the launch. And I think that's super critical to get the marketing right there. Because if we don't see numerous speculators and there's only like... Well, obviously, if no one uses it, well, then it's a flop. But if you have like only one speculator who goes wild, then that's just as bad as the scenario I was worried about previously, which is someone could literally buy up all the top brands on the cheap. I think it's a must-have to get multiple greedy speculators, and then it's off to the races.
And I kind of suspect if you get at least two who are well endowed, then committed to the system, and
I think just like there needs to be an incredible social media and overall marketing plan too. So when they are going head to head, like we just need to be slamming social media, talking about this guy versus that guy, and it's crazy. Crazy auction.
I'm not running anything. It's all going to be on the Bitcoin blockchain. So you can look at it and be like, look, that bid came in. That bid came in. That one's going up.
Yeah, I actually think there should be less. Like, I hear what you're saying, but like as little cheesy as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that the key is we can get a couple of credible people that are excited about it, and they're just like naturally.
What do you mean by
smash that like button.
I think there needs to be very strong marketing around this, otherwise it'll fail.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably like a
and there'll be undoubtedly be massive drama because the people who are Bitcoin is money and they think like, we aren't Bitcoin as money people will attack it. That'll create that'll create a circus show, but it'll create attention.
It's actually
the benefit of that ridiculous drama is attention.
Yeah. If only you had a podcast where you could like distribute this to the Bitcoiners.
Yeah. The entire, we just have to talk on this show.
Okay.
That's all.
I think it's super cool. It's extremely promising. And I think, one thing that I would also encourage you to do is, in addition to the technicals and I don't know if you're going to publish that for people to play with yet or if that's coming soon. But also, I think it'd be interesting to have more writing exploring what this unlocks. Because I think, again, this idea of digital land is very, in the same way that Bitcoin is amazing, but it's a primitive. And once you have Bitcoin as a primitive, you can do all of these new things like the credit and all the other stuff. I think with digital land, and the one area that I'm most interested in, and I'm curious your high-level comments on this is, particularly at a moment when agents are becoming the new default users of the internet, how does this map well with agents? I think there's a really interesting story to tell there.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's an interesting story to tell. I wouldn't say I have it distilled properly. Maybe Matt will have some
ideas. It seems super agent friendly and optimized though. So I think they're very compatible, but I agree that story needs to be told. Yeah. Vinny says, proposals create time for a competitive market to form around each name, though. I don't quite get that.
Proposals.
Well, he just means if you have to like start an auction and there's like some like time frame, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. This, I mean, this was kind of the balance is the original proposal for the system was to have floors of bonds, but to not have competitive auctions. And so you could grab something if you have your own name that you want to get that you don't want to get griefed on somebody else competing for your name, then it would sort of optimize for that case. And Steve was pointing out the brand case and sort of that we went down a bunch of different paths trying to sort of, can we explicitly list the top 100,000 brands? And then what about 100,001, 100,002? It just becomes this kind of like infinite task. You just kind of need to list everything. And I don't want to be in that kind of editorial, curatorial business. I kind of just want to be like, here it is, you know? So I think there is some risk that like, if you create Presidio Bitcoin, like presumably that should not get a lot of other people bidding on it, but maybe it does.
It would actually be kind of awesome if it does.
So at least 17 people should be participating.
But you'd want the end result that Presidio Bitcoin actually gets to own that, right? So,
but I mean, I personally don't care as much about that. Like I hear you maybe in the ideal case, but I think markets are going to market. Like I don't think there is like an ideal. It's like Presidio Bitcoin cares enough, they'll get it.
But we talked about we do think like anyone with an established brand, they should be the highest bidder. It's the brand is most valuable to them.
Totally.
Yeah.
So,
and if they're not, like I, in general, my philosophy is like markets will solve for this. Like if it's not as valuable to them, then it's more, I mean, if someone else expresses it's more valuable to me, then who are we to say it's not more valuable to them?
Yeah.
Right.
So we're coming close on time. We've covered one of our three headliner topics.
Gotta rug them.
Maybe we smash through the final two.
Smash away. Yes.
So Block smashes earnings. I mean, we're not like a financial reporting show here.
Well, I don't know. We spent
about an hour on that.
we're not like an earnings report that analysts. But anyway, I mean, I think Block had a good financial quarter.
We're just positioning for the acquisition.
Cute baby is our favorite analyst here. I think he was happy. But obviously Block employee. That's great. I mean, I think the more interesting story for us to talk about in the show, we're out of time today, but in the future is like Block as intelligence, right? And really like quadrupling down on that and completely transforming the company. Yeah. So I think
did that come out in earnings?
That's
though?
The on yeah.
Really?
I mean, well on the earnings call, one of the analysts asks that question and I forget, I'm paraphrasing, I forget exactly how the question is framed, but something about is like Block becoming an intelligence company or is that like at the forefront or the priority or something like that.
Yeah.
And I believe Jack said yes. So and I think as time goes on, we're going to see more and more of what's cooking at the company. So,
and it was a huge smash, right?
Yeah.
Is there any high level
cash app as it relates gross to profit? I mean, a key metric from any company, but Block highlights is gross profit. I think Block extra highlights that because revenue is very misleading with Block, and I keep seeing people miss this obvious thing, including Block employees. They get very excited or get nervous about revenue going up or down, which is a reasonable reaction for a lot of companies. But Block's revenue, the way the accounting works is that the Bitcoin like trading volume, not the money that Block makes, but just the price of Bitcoin literally impacts Block's revenue.
Yeah.
Right.
So basically ignore that.
Just kind of an
gross profit because that eliminates that. Anyway, gross profit for Cash App in particular grew year over year. I think, don't quote me on the numbers, but something like 36 or 38% or something. I mean, and everything's always relative to expectations, right? So, and it blew out expectations.
Well, do we have any ideas why? I know Block did more marketing with like the Bitcoin faucet day. Obviously, they've been pushing more on the.
I don't think the Bitcoin faucet was the right.
on accepting
give away lots of money and then you get better.
Turns out, well, we've had some debates with Nick on MBK, you know, on that.
I don't know what drove it. other than just being a great product. But I doubt it was the Bitcoin faucet on Bitcoin Day. But
Bitcoin is, I guess, trending as a more meaningful part of Block's business.
I don't think that is true.
Okay. I was just,
I mean, 38% growth. That seems,
it could be, well, that could be relative to.
I don't believe. Yeah, I'm definitely not like a company official on the financials.
Fair.
I don't think Bitcoin is leading the charge here.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Not yet.
I guess. Yeah. I meant more like, do we have a little bit of color? Like, Block as a whole has been very successful and had a great quarter, and Bitcoin is obviously been an important kind of, let's say, it's always been planting the seeds for future things, and I think some of that has been showing up over the years. But is there any news or perspective offered around how Bitcoin may evolve or get more deeply integrated into products, or how it's helping, you know, helping the existing portfolio products?
Well, I mean, I think you know, maybe go back like 1 or 2 years ago, I think Bitcoin-related products were something like 3 to 4% of overall company gross profit, which I found like quite compelling, actually. I mean, it's not a rounding error. It's not the cash cow for the company, but 3 to 4% and growing quickly was great. I don't know what it is right now. I sense that it's maybe still around that amount. And so then why did it weaken? Well, one is there's just less retail buying and selling Bitcoin. I mean, that's people true. Are buying ETFs now.
Okay, yeah.
And then two,
or just
and then
less
two, the withdrawing. Market. Another way the company made money off of Bitcoin was if you withdraw on chain, you pay a fee to the company, and part of that goes to the mining, but part of it went to Cash App, and Lightning is a much cheaper way to withdraw. So over time, Lightning is
the company.
literally spiral. Excellent. Not only does not generate
Excellent
revenue,
opens source investment, yeah.
Yeah, does not generate revenue. It is eating away at the revenue generated.
This is compelling for more open source.
CFO loves you.
Yeah,
yeah. Amrita to loves me. Yes, yeah. But in the long run,
yeah.
Cut out Visa.
Yeah, yeah.
Charge 1%, and all of that can go
cut
to the company.
Visa.
That's a better. That's a better deal.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, anyway, I mean, I think if you look across a number of financial metrics or whatever, is quite good. And in addition to just like current financial metrics, I think the shipping velocity, the product velocity is quite high right now, higher than it's been
definitely
in my 7 years at the company.
Definitely.
And I think it's only going to grow, which is obviously just good in its own right. But also when a company has such a substantial shift in how many employees it has, you know, reducing 40% or whatever a couple months ago, it's important to demonstrate that the company's not going to fall apart,
right?
When you have such a sudden change like that. So
would Block ever sell Bitcoin?
Yeah, I'll issue the definitive statement on that.
You never sell your Bitcoin.
I don't believe Block. I mean,
it was a joke.
Well, no, I mean, the criticism, I think a Bitcoiner criticism of Block or a Max Webster criticism is like, why aren't you buying more? I do think it's great that the company, I mean, the company bought in 2020 and was first public company and frankly was supposed to be the first company to do it. And Saylor beat Block by a month. Unbeknownst to Block, like Saylor was unknown to us.
Yeah.
But, you know, and made a couple nice sized purchases then, but then went like a few years with no purchases. Then I think it was like a couple of years ago, made a commitment to take a percentage of some financial metric, like the revenue or the gross profit of Bitcoin, take a percentage of that and buy Bitcoin, put it in the treasury every quarter. And so every quarter it's been doing that. It's relatively small. It's not as sexy as like strategy buys or even Coinbase. I think Coinbase just bought 88 million of Bitcoin. Wow. I think we reported in the quarter.
Shocked to hear that.
Something like that.
Not ETH?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Maybe
there's some alpha there.
I believe they own ETH, right? So I don't know if they do quarterly buys of Ethereum or not. That would be interesting to know.
Yeah.
If we had our AI agent here.
Yeah.
We really should consider doing that.
We basically need like Ori, but for voice.
I mean, we could be looking up on our laptops,
yeah,
but
yeah.
that's like takes away from the experience.
Yeah,
and it would be ridiculous to watch.
Yeah.
But if we can just have this if we can have this ambient AI agent that's listening
next year,
and then can like supply information on the
screen. This is Ori for voice agents, yeah. Right? Maybe MDK.
Nick, if you're listening.
Side project.
Yeah. So
we said his name, so.
Anyway, or if Spiral starts doing AI stuff, maybe we can supply this.
There you go.
Let's go.
Yeah. Future like episode.
It. Or when DK is done.
The pre-alpha. The pre-alpha yeah. drop. Spiral AI.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, well, enough on block earnings.
All right.
And then Anthropic partners with XAI.
The least sexy topic.
Or who is it? Oh, our friend JJ is saying that within 18 months, Anthropic will have a larger market cap. No, well, maybe
larger, I think it was.
But also market cap? I don't know.
Probably. I mean,
more valuable than Google.
But first, BitSensor is going to overtake them all.
Yeah.
I kid. The BitSensor take is a bad one, but that one's a pretty interesting one. I mean, high level, to me, this is one of the more interesting stories in the world for many reasons. And I know we're way over time, so we could do this for an hour next week, but my God, is Anthropic a beast of a company? Mm-hmm. My God, are they just an incredible product, continue just to grow. And it's interesting, you know, I listened to, I guess, Dario on a podcast maybe 6 or 7 months ago, and he was kind of like, well, you know, we've got a lot of compute, and he was being pushed like, why don't you have a lot more compute? He's like, well, we have to balance, we don't go bankrupt. Meanwhile, you have, to their credit, Elon, obviously, Google, and Sam at OpenAI just like, no, like, we're really scaling Law Build, which I thought Dario was the most scaling Law Build. But perhaps he was the least, you know, able to raise capital of that group. And they all just kept buying infrastructure, like build. The demand will come, you know, almost in a religious manner. And it seems like Anthropic did a lot, to be fair, but way less than the others. And, you know, at that same time, Anthropic just like mooned, overtook mm-hmm. everyone, including OpenAI, because of their, which we discussed a few episodes ago, extremely savvy bet on enterprise versus consumer. OpenAI has since pivoted. Now it's more of a neck and neck race. But anyways, but the TLDR is like, you know, Steve was complaining 2 or 3 episodes ago that now Anthropic was the best, but now they're throttling everything. I started noticing that. Like, I even, you know, started paying for a while. You could get free. It was incredible and like almost unlimited usage. Then I paid. And then they started throttling me after I paid. I got like one more question. I was like, yeah, this is bullshit. So clearly they had way more. I mean, it's a great problem for a startup to have. It's like the greatest problem in the history of problems. Too much demand. They just literally can't service it. So then we saw the announcement from them first. You know, they did a deal, an additional deal with Amazon, which is already a major investor. You know, part of the deal was to use Trainium Trips, Amazon's sort of NVIDIA competitor. And I think that was, you know, part of the deal is getting another $5 billion worth of, or not 5 billion, another 5 gigawatts of compute from Amazon, which has access. Then they did another deal with Google, which is a major owner. By the way, Google, the best VC of all time with SpaceX and Anthropic. Oh my God. And that was worth $10 billion immediately, and the ability to scale to $40 billion, a lot of that coming, I assume, in the form of TPU compute credits from Google Cloud.
And I thought this last week, did they say they committed $200 billion over 4 or 5 years?
From Google,
and
even
Anthropic
on top of that?
Is going to spend that? I don't know if it included those other numbers.
I don't know. But I mean,
saw a headline, I don't know.
Clearly part of that, and I think that's another interesting sort of conversation to pursue in the future, is like NVIDIA is the king. I mean, will TPUs be as good or better? Will Trainium be as good or better? Like that to me is like a material risk or question for Anthropic. Like maybe, but like, I mean, you still have to prove it, right? And send, but then on top of that, the real money shot of the week is, you know, I think it's interesting when this was announced. I've got my own sort of social dynamics read on this. Yeah. But now, you know, people were reporting that XAI, which has by far the most compute of anyone. I mean, Elon is the GOAT at securing energy and compute. That they were underutilizing. I read they were using like 10, 11% of all of their potential capacity for Grok models, which is crazy low. Number one, you know, as much as I'm a big fan of the sort of Tesla and XAI ecosystem, that suggests that, you know, Tesla is sadly at this point not, or XAI is sadly not at the same level as certainly Anthropic and OpenAI, maybe Google. So that's number one. Number two, it's a great business opportunity. So Anthropic announced they're now going to be partnering with OpenAI and using some of that excess XAI. Compute. Oh, sorry. Yeah, XAI. Thank you. Definitely not OpenAI. And then on top of that, I think it's very interesting that from what I saw, I don't have any personal information on this, but the fact that Elon has not been, let's say, a fan of Anthropic, always calling it misanthropic.
Right.
The fact that he and Dario sat down, he came out and said, quote, I don't get the evil vibe from them. Says a lot that he's doing this in the middle of, you know, a very now infamous trial with opening eye just tells me like how much he loathes Sam.
Right.
And I mean, I guess the enemy of my enemy is now my friend is kind of playing out. Just like the social dynamics, I mean, first of all, can we just like pause and say like how like fascinating this is? This is the most interesting story in the history of capitalism. Yeah. We're watching a race. Yeah. It's just so many dynamics and it's changing every day. And it's fun to watch in real time. And hopefully at the long end run, I think the worst case scenario is anyone gets too far ahead of everyone else. Like, I think you need market competitive dynamics to make sure there's not like a monopoly, one model to rule them all of the universe. But assuming that doesn't happen, it doesn't seem like it's happening yet, knock on wood. Man, this is just like, this should lead to a lot of consumer surplus. Yep. It should lead to a lot of abundance. And it's pretty fun to watch.
And I think so, yeah, totally agree and appreciate everything you say, you said there. One thing I'll note is I think, you know, OpenAI, I think, tried to kind of be the everything AI company. And so they were like doing like pendants or hardware and all kinds of, you know, they're doing some of everything. And I think Anthropic, you know, probably somewhat focused. Given where they were focused. Now, you could argue maybe they were too focused. They said, we're going to just be this model layer for enterprise software. And that is just going to be like, you know, for coding. And that's just going to be the thing. And so you could argue they maybe were too focused and didn't do enough compute. But then I think you could also, you could say that like the XAI challenge is that they had no developer type of tools, really, like no coding agents. They were like, plugged into X. And so consumer use cases are just not going to be, if you can throw 100 agents on a bunch of coding tasks and then walk away and they're working on that 24/7, obviously it's going to consume tons of tokens. And XAI didn't really focus on that use case, but they did focus on this other layer. So in a sense,
it's
not
complimentary.
Just the personality stuff, but I think they sort of arrived at a place where they turn out to be great complements to each other.
Did they merge?
Oof. I don't know.
SpaceX buys Anthropic.
Or Anthropic buys SpaceX if it's bigger than Google.
At the route it's going. I mean, if JJ is right and it's about to pass Google. I mean,
I think that's nonsense, but yeah.
but I mean, who
I think
knows?
It's provocative. Yeah, anyway, it's
provocative.
Fun to...
I mean, like, but like, if I had told you 3 years ago they would be a trillion dollar company within 3 years, you would have said that's nonsense too. So, I mean, who knows? One just kind of like,
Final thought. We're giving people bonus 20 minutes.
Bonus 20 minutes is, it's very interesting to me. My understanding is this gives you just an idea of how much compute Elon controls is his argument. I mean, I'm sure some of it is, you know, he's not going to come out and say this, they're not doing as well as they'd like. But to be fair to him, on the other hand, he's also saying, look, we're now training the next gen on Colossus 2. Therefore, Colossus 1 is radically underutilized. Mm-hmm. Cool. Colossus 1, of course, is located in the M, super intelligence, being born in Memphis, Tennessee. That's right.
Yeah.
I hope that leads, by the way, eventually it's all solar and batteries because, you know, I'm not a fan of the nat gas being burned with my compatriots. But that's coming, I believe. And I hope it leads to more jobs and all kinds of good things for Memphis. But Elon, if you're listening to this, on the off chance that you are, or someone at XAI,
we'll clip it and tag them.
And you want to continue to build the love with the Memphis community and have them so excited.
And
might I tell you, NIL for the University of Memphis would go a very long way. It's a basketball town, and you know FedEx is our only donor. It would be incredible, life changing, for Elon to step in, make sure that we can beat Iowa State next year. That would also be funny for Steve, you know, rubbing in his face a little bit. So just saying, Elon, this actually would work. NIL, Memphis Tigers basketball. It's a really, really, really big deal. If you want the community on your side, there it is.
Well, on that note.
True story.
True story.
On that note, there were no rugs, none detected.
No rugs. We just gave you a long episode.
It was a long one.
Yeah.
But that was a fun one.
All righty.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Until next time.
Have a good weekend.
Oof. Maybe I just shifted the.